thanks. It's nice to be back in Charlottesville. I've told John that I've yet to decline an invitation to come back here. I spent about 10 years after graduating trying to convince my spouse, who I met down here, that we ought to move back, and I've has yet been unsuccessful, but I'm not giving up hope. I've got a lot of great memories here. Just coming back, although the actual facility looks quite different. But, you know, 20 plus years ago, I was in the Environmental Law Forum, and I remember getting permission to put the recycling bins in the hallway and signing up for the recycling kind of duties to take all the cans from the vending machines out. And I should also note, as my own personal measure of the passage of time, one of the things I did while here in the law school was active in an organization that I know still exists, Action for Better Living, or ABLE. And I only mention it because I've got out there. He doesn't want to come hear me speak. My little brother from ABLE, who I took trick-or-treating when he was in fourth grade and is now celebrating his 34th birthday today. And I'm going to grab him for lunch afterwards, so it just gives you a sense of the passage of time. The law school, I know, has produced a great number of environmental lawyers, ones that we've got in our shop in the Office of General Counsel, folks who we encounter in our practice, certainly at EPA. And I think the newer ones at least have the benefit of studying with Professor John Cannon, one of my predecessors, and somebody that is extraordinarily both beloved and respected at EPA and in OGC. And I will share with you, though this will be, I predict, a bit of an embarrassing anecdote for you, John, that when I took the position as general counsel and people were letting me know about prior generals counsel, I mean, many of whom I knew anyway, and I've known John for many years. They referred to the time under the stewardship of John as Camelot in OGC. So it gets you a sense of the pressure when you take the position and have to deal with that as your past. I'm also grateful to have the chance to talk to you all today about the topic that you've chosen, and I should acknowledge the presenters that we've had today, who I know are experts in their respective field. I've got some of my own OGC lawyers here who I consider among the nation's experts in FIFRA and the issues that we're dealing with, so I'm pleased to have them to rely on. But the interesting thing to me, and again, I'll get to why I think it's so interesting in a moment, is the notion in today's kind of political and environmental moment to talk about, as part of a symposium, reconciling the issues with FIFRA and the Endangered Species Act. And it's because it comes in the midst of a lot of other things that are going on. We are, not surprisingly, in this administration and at this time, trying to address climate change. It was just yesterday, for example, that EPA made another announcement, released some more information about our Clean Power Plan, our Clean Air Act proposal to deal with pollution at power plants. And we've got public comments. I think we're at a million and counting. So talk about the degree of importance for generations to come and interest certainly across the country. And I should also note across the globe. As an aside, I was in China earlier this year as part of a U.S. delegation to the Strategic and Economic Dialogue in Beijing. All people wanted to talk about in Beijing was a Clean Air Act proposed rule that EPA's got. So it gives you the sense, just in terms of what we're doing at the agency, certainly the importance of that. We also are in the midst of a rulemaking under RCRA to deal with coal ash. And many of you all will remember back in 2008, the big TVA Kingston spill, where you had 5 million cubic yards of coal ash slurry rushing out of the impoundments into adjacent rivers and lands. And more recently, we had the Duke Energy spill into the Dan River in our neighboring North Carolina. We continue to work on big waters of the U.S. Rulemaking, which really addresses the fundamentals, the scientific connectivity of waters that give us jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act in this country. And we're really looking at ways of better protecting under that statute the kinds of streams that provide drinking water to over 115 million Americans. And I could go on and on about the breadth of things that we're dealing with. And you all chose for the topic of your symposium the ESA and FIFRA. And I think in doing so, you actually tried to, and successfully, I should say, found one of the more vexing and complex issues that we're dealing with. And I can attest certainly in my time back at EPA, I started there, I should note, right out of University of Virginia Law School back in 92 and spent a couple years before moving to the Justice Department. And so I got back in 2009. And of all the issues, I should say, that I have observed present some of the greatest challenges for the federal family writ large to implement, it's the one that you all settled on for your topic today. In many respects, if you kind of juxtapose that with climate and some of these other things I talked about, there is a relative luxury about dealing with a single agency administering a single statute, you know, with a single pollutant, for example. And you all have decided to assemble folks to talk about and debate and explore an issue that deals with multiple agencies, multiple statutes, obviously countless species and pesticides that we're dealing with, all coming together in a time of declining resources. A time of that is, shall we say, litigation rich, and when we have and are working through some substantial uncertainties in the science. It's clear that we have a legacy, as some of the past speakers have talked about, of some inaction here. And I don't want to dwell on it, but I don't want to ignore it either. But I do think that the time is right. The time is right for this symposium. The time is right for the path that we've charted. I was very pleased to see, in some ways, all of the different speakers that preceded me talking about the importance of the path we're on now, the importance of making sure that we seize this opportunity to actually make progress rather than take any steps backwards. We're at a time, which you've heard a little bit about, and which I'll touch on a little bit, where we had, I'd say, vast disagreements amongst the scientific community, and really I'm focusing on within the federal family, within the respective services and EPA. And we're at a time where we're starting to see, I think, an increase in collaboration, an increase in understanding, an increase in a settling on the right sorts of processes and the right sources of data and other information that can make us figure out how to knit these two statutes together in a way that does a service to both their missions and our respective mandates. So I want to spend my time with you all today to talk a little bit about, I think, where we're heading. I want to make sure that we acknowledge some of the challenges ahead. There certainly will be some, because I think our success is really going to be how we address the challenges and not how we figure out ways to avoid them. First, let's just focus on some of the numbers that we're dealing with. We've got over 900 active ingredients, 20,000 registered pesticide products that are already on the market. These are applied all over the country. They're applied in different amounts for different purposes by all sorts of different applicators. And most of us in this room can't divorce ourselves from this fact. We are indeed all, in a way, downstream consumers of these pesticides. We put food on our tables, and so notwithstanding you know, how you go about shopping. The fact is that virtually every American family and people far and wide are in a way connected to the economic sector that in large or small part relies on the application of some of the pesticides that we're dealing with. Just here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, I think we've got over 40,000 registered farms. And nationwide, we're talking about, just in terms of, farmland, over 900 million acres of farmland in this country. At the same time that we've got those concerns and those interests, of course, to deal with, we've got something like 1,800 species listed as either endangered or threatened. And just to give you all a sense, though this has little bearing on certainly the job I have now, but of my own background and interest, when I was a kid, I used to give as birthday gifts to people, my friends, annual subscriptions to the Fund for Animals. Because you know, I was one of those kids who saw the television ads about the fur seals and the clubbings, and I immediately gravitated towards wildlife protection and an interest in species. So I come to this issue, and certainly part of my feelings, if you will, as we work through these challenging issues, is a tremendous affinity and appreciation for the diversity of species that we have here in this country and that we need to protect. We've already talked a little bit about EPA's responsibility under FIFRA. It's a balance of risks and benefits, looking at, as we register pesticides, making sure that we don't cause unreasonable adverse effects on the environment. And we also share a requirement under the Endangered Species Act with all the other federal agencies to consult under Section 7, as has been touched upon. But it hasn't been easy. It's been a difficult path. And I remember when I came back to EPA in 2009, one of the most extraordinary meetings that I attended upon coming back was indeed relative to what has been referred earlier to the mega suit. And you know, if you are ever sitting in the role of a defense counsel, which is general counsel I am, that if somebody calls your litigation the mega suit, it's not a good thing. And I remember in particular being in a meeting with folks from the Justice Department and the Department of Commerce and the Department of Interior and EPA. And up until that point in my return to the agency, I kind of always thought that we were all on the same side. Everybody got along, and it was people not at the table and outside the room with whom we were formulating strategies and trying to make sure that, you know, the science aligned and we were developing the right record to uphold the law. The degree of, candidly, of disagreements that were expressed at that table, now, not an unwillingness to find solutions, and I tip my hat to everybody in the respective agencies for the progress we've made so far. But, you know, 5-6 years ago, things were not so easy to see. The path ahead, I think, was a little bit less clear before us. If there was ever an issue that laid bare some serious and significant differences of opinion, even opinions on the science or the degree of science that was needed to do our respective duties, it was in the mega suit in particular, but also in this issue in general. I think we've made a great deal of progress. And part of the difficulty has always been that the issue is kind of national in scope, but the science that we need to deal with, particularly with respect to endangered species, is often quite local, and it's a different paradigm than we've got in a lot of our other pollution control statutes, where we're looking at broad airsheds or large water bodies. It's very different than to consider, as we do under the Endangered Species Act, much more localized effects on species, whether threatened or endangered, whose critical habitats are in much smaller places. And you think about the sorts of risk assessments in science that you have to bring to bear on these things. And keep in mind, you have to take into account all sorts of effects from multiple pesticides, but also the interactions of other factors, like rain. It rains more in certain places than it does in others. And so the level of rainfall can be important as you're assessing risks on species or what happens with the pesticide. And so this is an example of the degree of localization that scientists and folks at EPA and the services really need to begin to grapple with. And so what should be self-evident just from my description so far and from what we've heard is that if you multiply all of these factors together, again, the numbers of species, the fact that you have multiple statutes and multiple agencies, and scientists with, in some senses, different backgrounds, but certainly who have come up thinking of themselves, I think, as having somewhat different missions within their respective agencies, we had difficulty figuring out an effective, efficient, reliable, transparent process to do the work that's needed under both of the statutes. And I say that not at all to disparage the integrity of all of the respective participants. And in fact, quite the contrary. I think the one thing that I have seen in my time in federal service is the tremendous level of public service that's brought to the table by federal officials of all stripes. And so I think that everybody has come to the table with a great degree of honesty and integrity, but that has not in and of itself always led to harmony. And you layer onto all of this a bit of fiscal reality, which is we're in an environment, shall we say, where resources are not unlimited. And that's important to consider. We have duties under the law, but we have a degree of resources that in and of itself brings certain constraints with it. If you think about EPA alone, I think back in 1990, and I've seen a chart recently about this, our budget today in real dollars, if you do the right discounting and account for inflation, is about the same in terms of its buying power as what we were 20 to 25 years ago. And you think about the increase in personnel we've got at the agency. Think about the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990 and all that that required EPA to do. Think about the number of pesticide registrations, to be specific, that have probably happened since 1990, all which needs to be done by the same dedicated workforce at EPA. And I have no doubt that similar constraints are being felt at the services and in other places in the government. So we've had to do more with less, and it has an impact on things. We need to prioritize. And if you think about just EPA's own re-registration review process, where we periodically re-register re-evaluated, say, currently registered pesticides, looking at that alone annually, we could generate more consultation requests of the services than they get from every other federal entity combined. So it gives you a sense of the relationship, if you will, between my agency, EPA, and the services and their work. And so what has evolved from all of this and has been discussed a little bit in the past was a need to look outside for additional scientific help, for some scientific clarity to, again, try to bridge some gaps between the scientists and others in our respective agencies, and to do so that so that we can actually chart a process going forward that has both fidelity to our respective statutes, but also provides a workable platform. Because I think among the things that we owe the American people is to implement our respective obligations as much as possible, not only in compliance with the law, but in a way that actually meets the needs of Americans and is a workable thing to do. And so we went outside of our kind of respective buildings. We went to the National Research Council of the NAS. In 2011, our former administrator, Lisa Jackson, wrote a letter to the NAS, basically requesting assistance, also on behalf of the Secretaries of Agriculture, Commerce, and Interior. Everybody, importantly, was on board with this approach. And in fact, it would undoubtedly not harbor an opportunity for success, I think, if any of the services, or EPA for that matter, were not in agreement on this particular course. The NAS thankfully took on the charge, and as we've heard, in April of 2013, issued its recommendations in a report. It recommended in part that the agency, in order to have kind of manageable consultations, we had to be able to prioritize the most risky pesticides for evaluation first. It's not enough, again, given what we're dealing with today in the constraints and resources, to simply throw a dart at the board of pesticides and actions and species. We have to be smarter. We have to be smarter because we have limited resources. We have to be smarter because the science tells us that some risk to species some species are more imperiled than others. And so collectively, we have to come together and figure out, again, where can we make the greatest difference soonest? And I think, fortunately, the NAS recognized that. And we think kind of credibly, and I believe there's agreement on this with the services as well, that the riskiest pesticides are actually the existing ones. They're not necessarily, in all instances, the newer ones that are coming on market. It's the older, the more simpler pesticides that have more toxic chemistries that we need to look at first. These are the ones that, generally speaking, may affect more species in more profound ways than the newer pesticides. And the NAS report has really had, I think, a positive impact. If you look at the degree of collaboration today versus just a couple years ago, I think you will see marked differences. I think the processes are understood by the respective experts in the agencies. They are agreed upon. We have clarified roles. We have strengthened relationships. And all of this may sound like window dressing a little bit, given kind of where we've come from. But I think that there is a consensus among those that really pay close attention to the important intersection of these statutes, the important interests that are at stake both on the species side and in the agricultural sector, that the process that is now underway and the differences we see today are not just ephemeral. These are things that I think will take hold, they will take root, and they will pay significant dividends as we go forward. One of the things that I have often dealt with, not just, of course, in the ESA FIFRA context in my role as general counsel, is the degree to which the agency, again, given its mandates under the variety of statutes and our limited resources, it deals with litigation. As all of you all know, most of the statutes and certainly the APA provide opportunities for citizens and other interested persons to challenge the agency for its final agency actions. I think that this aspect of environmental law is probably what sets us apart in a positive way from so many other environmental governance systems around the world. I think that there is a tremendous amount of benefit that the agencies, EPA in particular, and the American people have gotten from the right of interested parties or organizations to take on the final actions of portions of its government. And so I think there is not only an opportunity for that, of course, under our statutes, but I would suggest a positive role that can be played by citizens of all stripes, industry, NGOs, it doesn't matter. And I say this knowing from the inside that we are an agency that gets sued roughly 150 times a year, and I know that from my own vantage point and my own perspective, that I think there are limits. There are limits to the benefits of those rulemakings. Outcomes from litigation are, by nature, sometimes unpredictable. Outcomes of litigation are, by nature, not always taking into account relative priorities. They don't necessarily follow lockstep the science in terms of what's going to get you the biggest bang for your environmental dollar. In a sense, from no fault of the particular parties, it is an up and down way, if you will, of having to administer statutes. And so I think that in this field in particular, although people alluded to the fact that there are still lawsuits going on, my fervent hope is that we are approaching, if you will, a place where collectively the parties can see the process through a little bit. We have, again, reached a point in time when we've got the scientists at the respective agencies at least on a consistent path as to how to look at things. And I would hate to see the federal family and all of the people who've got vested interests in making sure that these statutes are administered properly get taken off course, if you will, by litigation strategies that don't necessarily marry up again with the science and the ability of the agencies to make true and progressive action here. We have reached some great settlements lately. These, I think, are a tribute not only to the lawyers in my shop and the Justice Department, but also to the counsel at the organizations, the environmental organizations, who represent their interests and who are involved in those cases. Many of those cases come out of the Pacific Northwest and deal with salmonids, but importantly, they have set in motion and put, again, some boundaries, if you will, on a new biological opinion pathways for at least five pesticides in particular. And it's a positive sign that I think we've got the agreement certainly of the environmental parties, but also the fact that, importantly, industry didn't oppose these settlements. Again, the path forward, my hope is, certainly following many of the NAS recommendations, is one that will bring some common sense, but also will pay tribute to the important needs of both of the statutes. And as we move forward with the biological opinions here, and as you all kind of continue to think about, where is this heading? Where is this reconciliation of the statutes heading? I want to take only a slight detour and talk about something that that you all, mostly as younger lawyers or lawyers-to-be, will confront, and that is the information revolution. Because if you look in much of what EPA does, and certainly, in the area of FIFRA and ESA, information is king. We need data. We need information to make good scientific and policy decisions. It used to be that the data came from biologists and specialists only. But times really are changing, and we need to think how that's going to impact our work, your world, our field collectively. There was mention earlier of geospatial data in particular. It helps us and farmers learn where our species are or could be located in relation to crop production. That allows us to better target pesticides or figure out areas that we ought to avoid. Industry, of course, has a stake in this too. Monsanto, I think, is helping with some of this work. USDA is involved in generating additional data on cropped areas where pesticides are used most heavily. We're trying to get this information out to the public and to farmers. One of the ways, importantly, that we do this is through the use of countywide bulletins. These are given to farmers. They're out there. They have a lot of information about pesticide restrictions. I know they're on our website. I think there's an application called Bulletins Live. And so if you're a farmer in Virginia, you can actually go online. You enter the county in which you're farming, the time of year that you're applying pesticides, and it will help identify the restrictions that are in place relative to your particular location and that pesticide. We've got something similar online called the Salmon Mapper. Again, the same idea, that you can go online, identify where you're looking to apply pesticides, and it gives you information about a requisite buffer zone next to the streams where the salmon might be. And so that's some of the things that are happening in the FFRA or the ESA context, but it's much more broad than that, of course. There once was a day when, if you think about the Clean Water Act world, discharge monitoring reports, that was where we got our information about water pollution. And air, we got the information about air monitors that were widely dispersed and probably too infrequently read, not to mention relatively inaccessible to folks. And so I like to think about if information is power, it was kind of an environmental oligarchy where only a few owned the sources of information and therefore kind of knew what was in our environmental playbook. We had transmission lines. We had sources of information that ran from inside the fence line or inside a farm, for example, right to a federal regulatory agency. And so your players in the discussion, if you will, were necessarily dependent on who had access to that information. But times have changed. I think we all are carrying around smartphones now. And we are, if not already at the time where we've got apps in our phones that will allow us to get real-time data, we are only months, if not years, away from a time where people will hold their cell phones up in the air and get real-time emissions reports, or they'll dip a stick or something in the water, get those real-time readings, or they will take a picture of a particular crop or field or observed species, and with the touch of a button, and without much interpretation, and that carries with it its own risks, disseminate that information widely. And I think at EPA, we need to take seriously this proliferation of data. I think it provides challenges to us, but I also think it provides a great deal of opportunities. And inevitably, I think this increased exposure to information, how we QAQC it, how we talk about it, how we interpret it, how we receive it, how we screen it. These are the things that all of us need to grapple with, but it will become a part of our ESA and FFRA conversation, I predict, in the years to come. Just in closing, the one last thing that I wanted to talk a little bit about, and I mentioned this at the outset, was climate change. And there's a great deal of focus, certainly, at EPA on the rules that we're putting forth under the Clean Air Act to address carbon pollution. And I think we've got a tremendous potential. We've got a proposal out there that, if finalized, would cut carbon pollution from power plants by up to 30%. Once 2030 rolls around. We've got tremendous benefits already from cutting carbon pollution out of the tailpipes of our motor vehicles in this country. So there's a lot of focus on on the air world and what we're doing vis-a-vis the climate. But the fact is that as the climate is changing, as we're getting different weather patterns and more extreme weather events, we are seeing movement of crops. You will see movement of species. You will see different impacts, perhaps, on the application or the use of particular pesticides. And so even if your focus is more narrowly on pesticides and FIFRA, there are things that are in the offing, if you will, in the area of climate change that will dramatically, perhaps, impact the way in which we do business. And so I think our scientists, not just dealing with the reconciliation issues that we've talked about here today, need to really give some thought in all areas of environmental law, how not only we are going to mitigate any of the harms that come from carbon pollution and climate change, but more forcefully, how are we going to bring our expertise, our knowledge, and our creativity to resiliency and adaptation strategies, again, that are going to measurably work for all Americans, for all sectors of our economy, and certainly for the species with whom we share this country. So with that, let me just close and say this is, I think, an exciting time to practice environmental law. I think it's a great time to be at the University of Virginia Law School in particular, and kind of urge you all to take advantage of all the opportunities you have with Professor Cannon and others in the environmental field, but also to take advantage of the experts that you've got here in this room, at the Center for Biological Diversity, at the Florida College, at Beveridge and Diamond, elsewhere. I feel very strongly that all of us will do a little bit better in our lives, whether it's administering statutes or whatever we do, if we figure out ways to listen better, listen more productively. You all have at your fingertips a tremendous amount of resources. So to the extent that any of us who are fervently engaged in trying to make FIFRA and the ESA work and work well fall at all short, and I hope we don't in our efforts in the upcoming years, my hope is that that the folks here who have an interest in this can stand us up, both support us and lead us as we move forward, because I do think that there's a great deal of promise that can be had. So thanks very much, and enjoy the rest of your symposium.